This month, The Spectator becomes the first magazine in history to print 10,000 issues, and we'd like to celebrate with you. Subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a bottle of commemorative Spectator gin, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/celebrate.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. So going into the weekend, we have the opening of the first coronavirus-specific hospital in London, with honours done by Prince Charles remotely. And there's rumours abound that the day government figures will have the highest death toll and ultimately the peak of the infection could be Easter Sunday. James, what's the mood in government?
So the government had for quite a while expected that the peak of this virus would come in that week beginning on Easter Sunday, the week beginning April 12th. I think the question in government now is, I think there's a mix depending on what your focus is, which is, I think there is a feeling that they are successfully expanding the capacity of the NHS to deal with this. But then I think there is a big question about how long the current lockdown is sustainable for in terms of both the economy and public consent. And I mean, that is going to be one of the big issues going forward. I also think the fact that the Queen is going to address the nation at 8 p.m. on Sunday suggests that this week is when the government expects things to start getting really bad.
Fraser, Boris Johnson has told us repeatedly that it is going to get worse before it gets better. Do you think that the public's rather braced for what we're expecting over the next couple of weeks in terms of a sharp increase in fatalities? If you speak to figures in government, there is a sense that if they can keep the death toll below 20,000, that would be, relatively speaking, showing that they had the infection under control compared to a worst-case scenario.
Yes, there's still a lot of doubt about the figures. I mean, we know in Britain that 1,600 die a day. We're also told that now there are 500, 600 people dying with COVID every day. It's not sure these are extra deaths, that the death toll has gone up appreciably, or whether it's the case that those who were anyway passing away, a greater share of them were getting COVID. So we don't know now because the data hasn't come out yet. If it's the case that hospitals are right now seeing lots and lots and lots more patients, lots of more dead bodies, whether the scenes are as bad as the figures suggest, or whether the numbers we're seeing are to a large extent simply a sign of how common COVID now is amongst people in hospitals. This is something that Sweden's been grappling with. I wrote about this in my Daily Telegraph column today. They're changing their COVID metric, so they only count as a COVID death somebody who the medics believe died as a result of contracting COVID, rather than the many people who have got heart disease or lung complications who die with the disease. Now, the Swedes think that this could reduce the COVID death numbers by anything from 2/3 to 4/5. It's not quite clear yet, but that will be a very interesting part of the puzzle, because right now, globally, we're talking about people, the COVID deaths figures are those who have died with the infection. So the numbers might be deceptive in that they don't really give us a scale of the problem. But the public are certainly braced for this. The public are braced for the worst public health crisis in our lifetimes. That's why we're in lockdown. That's why the economy is crashing by 20%. It is all worth it in relation to the threat of the public health crisis. That's what the government's been telling us anyway. If anything, I think people were braced for a lot worse last week. It was the general feeling that the NHS was about to hit the storm last weekend. We find out now that NHS hospitals are still able to cope. Even in London, we're told, they haven't hit the limits of intensive care units. So the government will be expecting perhaps the worst week to come now, a week later than I think many of them had originally expected it to hit.
James, the polling currently suggests that the public overwhelmingly do support the lockdown that we are currently in, the social distancing measures. But there is a sense in government that this could change quite quickly. For example, there are particular worries about this weekend, the fact there's going to be good weather. So there's a lot of talk about an exit strategy. How much time is being spent in government thinking about an exit strategy from the lockdown, and what are the options being mooted?
So, Casey, I think you're right that the public currently support the lockdown. I think the fact that Boris Johnson recorded a video basically saying, look, it's going to be a lovely, beautiful weekend, but please stay inside. You need to stay inside to slow down the spread of the virus, shows the concerns in government. And I think the public will continue to support the lockdown in a circumstance where every day we get this grim daily death toll and it is higher than that of the day before. I think when the public mood might begin to change is if when the number of deaths begins to go on a kind of downward trajectory. Now, that probably is not going to happen until towards the end of this month. But I think if that happens and the economic damage of this virus, you know, and the economic and social damage, you know, 850,000 more claims than usual for universal credit in the past fortnight, if that continues through this month, then I think you might see public opinion begin to shift. I think there are few views in government about how the exit strategy is. Boris Johnson himself says, you know, testing is the way out of this. And there are two ways that that could work. One is at Portland Down, the government's, you know, very advanced lab, they're trying to kind of construct a sample of the population so they can see how widespread coronavirus has been. Now, if it turns out that far more people have had coronavirus than the government thought, essentially that Oxford University model was pretty broadly right, then that suggests one possible way out of the current situation. Another option is to try and embrace a kind of South Korean-style track and trace. I think there are two big problems with that. The first is that even if you hit that target of 100,000 tests a day by the end of the month, that would still not be enough, sufficient to allow for a kind of track and trace style policy. And secondly, track and trace does require a level of intrusion into people's privacy that I think could be quite hard to get the public to accept. And thirdly, the fact that Singapore, which has been doing something similar, has had to announce a lockdown of most workplaces and schools shows that, you know, there are limits to what track and trace can achieve. So I think the second argument is essentially that with this increase in NHS capacity through the Nightingale hospitals and the like, and if the death toll starts to fall by the end of this month, that you could have a kind of begin to see a gradual easing off of some of the restrictions. You know, first of all, people being allowed to get back to work, aim of getting kids back into school for a couple of weeks before the summer holidays begin. I mean, that's regarded as being quite important psychologically, and then gradually building up to a return to normality. But I think there is no easy answer to the exit strategy question. But I think that people are beginning to realise is that this isn't a simple debate between lives and the economy. It's a debate that recognises that if this country becomes permanently poorer, which I think there is no doubt it will if this lockdown were to continue all the way through to the autumn, we would not be able to afford such a good health service in future. And that would lead to more people dying prematurely. There is a general reason why richer societies have higher life expectancies than poorer societies.
Fraser, as you touched on, there are many unknowns still in coronavirus in terms of the figures, and lots of countries are trying different approaches. When it comes to the idea of slowly easing social distancing, is one of the factors here in the government's decision making going to be what happens in Wuhan, for example, where we are ultimately going to see what happens when you move from a suppression strategy to one where people start to move around again and open the door?
Well, this is a debate which is being held within government right now. I was speaking to a government minister this morning who was saying that it's not clear, even inside government, what the purpose of a lockdown is. Is this about buying time for the NHS so the NHS can prepare? That's what the Prime Minister had told us a couple of weeks ago. And that strategy has worked. The NHS is now upscaling, not just in London, but in Manchester and Cardiff as well. So does that mean that Britain can go back to this policy we had before, which is a Swedish-style strategy of going about our normal life to the extent that NHS capacity will allow? So is this not really about trying to suppress the virus? Is this simply about trying to manage the toll on the NHS? If that's the case, then lockdown might be able to end a lot faster. Now, one of the things the government isn't telling us, rather suspiciously in my view, is they're not telling us how many of their intensive care units are being used. Now, in Sweden, they're telling this every single day. You can go on the Swedish website and get live information. Yesterday, their state epidemiologist was saying that only a quarter of intensive care units are being used in Sweden. This is very important information for Swedes because they need to know, can the health service cope? How bad are things? So the Swedish government is sharing information every day to justify their sort of soft lockdown. The government isn't forcing Swedes to stay inside. It's basically asking them to behave themselves, to stay away from elderly relatives. And it's doing this, it's trying to earn consent by sharing information. Now, we've got no idea, really, what the situation is in the NHS. That information will exist. Every day, ministers know what proportion of intensive care units are used. But this isn't shared with the public. And I think it really should be. Because if it is the case that the NHS capacity has increased to a bit where there's a safe buffer, where we're not in danger of being overwhelmed, then that's the point at when you can start discussions about starting to end the lockdown, maybe putting children back to school. That, I'd say that's one of the most important things. And maybe allowing more people to work. But of course, if the purpose of a lockdown is trying to suppress the virus, then it doesn't really matter how busy or not the NHS hospitals are. We ought to stay locked up until this thing goes away. Well, that's certainly some of the arguments you see passing about. And it's still not clear, even to those within government, what the end game is, what the exit strategy is. Is the exit strategy, wait until we get NHS capacity, in which case great, but let's hear how the NHS is getting on? Or are we trying to stay indoors until we somehow defeat or limit the coronavirus, in which case we could all be in for a far longer haul?
I think in the same way that public opinion was crucial in the shift to the lockdown becoming compulsory, I think the kind of view in Downing Street was that you needed the public consent for that to happen. You needed the public to be there. I think public opinion is going to be, frankly, I mean, let's be realistic, it is going to be crucial to when this lockdown is lifted. Because in reality, even with the police being granted these powers, if people begin to flout the lockdown, the government can't realistically, enforcing it is very, very difficult. And so I think where the public opinion is going to be play a very big part in when these restrictions are eased. That's obviously the bit that no politician wants to admit publicly. But I think when you talk to people privately, it is quite clear that when the public's attitude to this lockdown and the public attitude to, as Fraser said, which one of those two things is the purpose of it, is going to be, I think, quite crucial in determining when the restrictions begin to be eased.
And Fraser, just finally, you've written about the Swedish example in your Telegraph column today, and we also have a piece in this week's magazine. In terms of the public's mood in Sweden, one of the things here is clearly Boris Johnson was in a way pressured into putting in social distancing measures when he did. A lot of people around him think he might have held off for a little bit longer if there hadn't been that public pressure. So is the mood in terms of the Swedish public one where they are fairly relaxed about the government's approach? Are they on board?
I wouldn't say it's relaxed, I'd say it's divided. There was an opinion poll recently that showed about 75% have got faith in the Swedish Public Health Authority, which, by the way, is managing the crisis here. The politicians are taking a back seat, and it's the epidemiologists and the public health officials who are running it. Now, 3/4 approval rate is pretty high, but the remaining 20% are getting pretty nervous. There was a letter, for example, signed by 2,000 researchers, scientists and luminaries, urging the Swedish government to change tack. Basically, the more sort of affluent and globally minded you are, the more nervous you are about the Swedish government's liberal approach. The further you go outside Stockholm, the more pleased you are that you do still have liberty to go about your daily business. Now, the public, it's funny, when you listen to the Swedish arguments that the officials are making, they're familiar because this is exactly what Patrick Vallance and others were making 3 weeks ago. The Swedish solution is the British solution just before the Imperial College study, which changed everything. So they are saying, as we were saying, look, you can't outrun this virus. Look, there's no point disbanding the schools. It would cause more harm than good. Look, it's still okay to congregate and watch social matches. The evidence shows that the virus doesn't spread that way. all of this which is being said in Sweden was once being said in Britain until, as you say, Katie, the government felt it just lost the argument with the public. Or when the Imperial study came along suggesting that 30% of those who are in hospital with a virus end up in intensive care, that suggested overwhelming numbers for the NHS, and so lockdown was implemented to stop the scenario. Now, as I say, the Swedish experiment is one which is being conducted in the open with the data being shared every single day. But right now, three quarters of the public are with them. They're being asked, they're being trusted by the government to use their common sense. They are by no means blithe about this. They're not in denial. A lot of people are working from home. The streets are a lot more subdued than they were, as are the trains and the transports. So yes, they're with the government now, and they're waiting to see, will this thing work? But in yesterday's press conference, the state epidemiologist said that he thinks the curve is actually flattening, is working better than they thought. So the question is, if a Swedish experiment actually works, that could change public opinion in Britain. Because if the Swedes show that you can handle this without lockdown, then Britain can do it too.
Well, that's certainly one to watch. And to hear more about Sweden and the approach the country is taking on coronavirus, do check out the Edition podcast this week, where Fredrik Eriksson is discussing his piece in this week's magazine.